You're listening to Don't Blink, the Doctor Who podcast on Golden Spiral Media. I'm David Ward, and joining me is my co-host Wayne Henderson. So don't blink, don't even blink. You're listening to Don't Blink on Golden Spiral Media. I'm David.
And I'm Smiling Wayne. Smiling, I tell ya.
And in this show, we're discussing Doctor Who Season 10, Episode 2, Smile. And I want to send a big thank you on behalf of my friends to all of you loyal listeners. I'm talking to you about Doctor Who, so I don't have to talk to them about Doctor Who. So they pass along their thanks. But very glad to be joined by Wayne today. And Wayne, what rating did you give Smile?
Well, this is what I'm talking about. I loved this episode. I'm going to give this one 9. That's right. 9 out of 10 interlocking microbots.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I loved it. And my rating is lower than yours, but it is done with a smile on my face, too. I'm going to give it 7, but a happy 7 pull to open signs, because I actually really did enjoy this one myself.
Excellent. So we're kind of flip-flopped a little bit from last week. But again, like you said, by the time we're done talking about it, maybe one of us will budge our rating in one direction or another.
Well, let's start, as we often do, with some voicemail feedback. We love to hear from our listeners, and we encourage as many of you as possible to email or call in.
Absolutely. You can be part of the show next week by giving us a call at area code 304-837-2278, or simply by using our voicemail widget from anywhere in the world at don'tblinkpodcast.com.
Hello, IT. Have you tried turning it off and on again?
Hey, this is Jeff X-Force 11 calling in for Don't Blink. David and Wayne, I enjoyed this episode for the insight that it gives into the Doctor. Once again, it kind of continues the theme of the producers teaching new Whovians about the Doctor through Bill's eyes. And that's a good thing. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the kind of the dialogues and the back and forth that way. The plot wasn't that wonderful. It was interesting, kind of an interesting play on things. And I wasn't really thrilled, but it was a story that moved things along and gave us some insight into the Doctor and Bill. So I enjoyed it for that way. I'm interested to hear what y'all have to think.
Jeff, thanks again for calling in. And he added later on that he gave this episode 8 out of 10 doctors who watch the IT crowd.
Yeah, sooner or later, they had to do the turn it off and on again bit. And it makes sense. So thanks for calling in, Jeff. Always good to hear from you. It's funny, there was a lot of grumbling about this episode on some of the forums.
And, really?
People weren't all that keen on it. And I almost felt that my enjoyment of it was based on the fact I knew it was going to be a very slow paced episode. And knowing that when you go in, I just was really, really taking my time with it. And this is from a man who watched Solaris twice back to front, which is a sort of 4-hour, very slow science fiction movie.
But dedication, David, right there.
It just got me in a certain mood and a certain headspace. And I really enjoyed kind of being there. So that's why I did it twice. But this had the same thing. It really did feel like episode 2, but in a really good way. It had that kind of sense of, okay, we're going to take a character moment. And it reminded me in a lot of ways of The End of the World, which was the second episode in Christopher Eccleston's season.
Oh, okay. And I'm going to totally agree with kind of knowing what we were going to get ahead of time helped us be in the right mindset, because, you know, seeing all the trailers and knowing that we were going to have a robot that speaks emoji, you know, we knew we weren't in for the most serious of science fiction tales.
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of a movie called Silent Running, which was a great film about a kind of floating botanical sort of spaceship that has got these two really cute robots that run around, and it's just one guy and these robots kind of playing poker with each other, and it's really great how they're sort of like anthropomorphized. And I thought these were the robots were great. I didn't think I'd like them, but the way that the expressions changed was sinister. I mean, when they go angry, it's very intense.
Absolutely. I do remember Silent Running, watching that on television when I was a kid. which one of the robots would you rather actually have if you could in real life? The one from Doctor Who's Smile or one of those cute little ones from Silent Running?
Well, I frown too much, so it would be Silent Running.
Oh, my. Okay.
And I, you know, we'll come to this, but I love the badges as well. The digital mood badges. And I'm already thinking, well, how can we cosplay that? And how can we make them so that they change with your expression? You know, you have a little clicker in your pocket and mm-hmm. change it.
Somebody's definitely going to come up with that. But I thought there were so many wonderful things in this episode. Some of the great conversations between the Doctor and Bill, not to mention the story, which, although it's not 100% original, I went along for the ride and loved it.
Yeah, the things that worked really well. You've got that great scene at the start in the TARDIS, and Moffat's really good at writing those sort of introducing people to Doctor Who moments. There's a really good deleted scene from the 11th Hour, which I recommend to all of our listeners, which is when Amy Pond gets that kind of talk, you know, where she says, "Are you an alien in a person's suit? And why do you wear bow ties? And why is it wooden?" And it's really, really brilliant. And it's a shame they took it out for timing reasons.
Is it easy to find?
Yeah, it's on YouTube. And it's it really should have stayed in the episode. But we get more of this from Moffat with Bill. I'm glad they kind of carried that on from last week. And actually, even Nardole, when he turns up and has that like little scene with the Doctor, I didn't think I'd like his character, but it's really good. I like his role when, as the sort of slightly annoyed kind of butler. It's brilliant.
Yeah, and this week he wasn't very keen on Bill at all. He doesn't want to become a slave to a human.
Yeah, that was a slightly odd exchange. But it also sets up this the idea of this vault and that he knows what's in it and that it's something really serious. And I quite like that concept for series 10, because so much of Moffat's story arcs is so complex and bizarre. I like just this basic idea of, I've got something in a vault and you're not going to find out for quite a while what it is. It really works for me.
Now, you think that Nardole does know what's in the vault. I'm not so sure. For yourself, do you have any guesses what might be in this vault?
I wonder if it's not the Doctor himself or herself. I wonder if it's not the future version, or maybe even an earlier version. That would be my punt at it. But there's not much information to go on at the moment.
It'd be interesting to see how Stephen Moffat writes that kind of thing and brings that to life. I mean, we don't even really know where the vault came from. And what is this oath that the Doctor agreed to stay on Earth? And who did he make that oath to? Just to Nardole or somebody else?
Yeah, I don't know. But again, it's nice and clean and simple. And it's definitely got my imagination going. So, but it was funny watching the Doctor kind of be naughty and be like, but we're not going to do that anyway. We're just going to go on a trip, which is great.
He is full of loopholes. And dear listener, if you have some ideas of what's in the vault, where did it come from, and who the Doctor made this agreement with for the oath, give us a call. We want to know your thoughts. 304-837-2278, or simply visit don'tblinkpodcast.com. We want to share that.
Yeah. You know, the crazier theory, the better. So, excuse me.
Yes, absolutely. The crazier, the better. Get those wheels spinning.
Yeah. We'll see. But so then we move to the planet itself after we have that first TARDIS scene, and we see the cornfields and this kind of very clean, white, utopian environment. What did you think about the planet and the design and all of that fun stuff?
I thought it was really well done. The first scenes where I guess the TARDIS is in the middle of, I guess it's a wheat field or something, that was very striking. And then when they get inside and we see all of the lush plants that are growing, that's when I really did also get the Silent Running kind of vibe. And then it turned sinister right away with this fertilizer. Oh my goodness.
Now you kind of immediately pick up on why the, because it's Doctor Who, on why the one character is saying, you've got to keep smiling, mm-hmm. you know, as the audience understand what the concept is. But I was just screaming out, just tell her, you're beating around a bush here. Just say, if you don't smile, I'll kill you. But she doesn't, like, she can't kind of spit it out. But those robots are wonderfully sinister. And I just love that idea of the face mirroring your own. I found that to be really interesting.
Amidst all of the death and fertilization and all of that, this episode was also filled with a lot of hilarity, which at a couple points, David, I'm like, should I be laughing at this? Like when the doctor tells Bill that, the colonists, they're coming to this planet to have a new Garden of Eden, but they didn't know that they were going to be the fertilizer, and just offhanded remarks all through the episode. But it's quite a nice looking planet. If Earth is going to send forth people to recolonize another world, if they can survive all of the microbots, I'm all for it.
That was another thing I liked about this, is that it wasn't dystopian, because normally you go off to some, colonizer planet or alien covenants about to come out. And that it's the, we should never have come sort of thing. And this, it's like, it makes sense. It wouldn't necessarily be a bitter fight for survival. If you can get to, a distant planet and you've got the technology to do that, it might be quite nice when you get there. it might be, you'd have a building that looks good. I think that this was filmed in Spain. So a lot of these locations are real. And there's apparently, I think it's maybe a museum of modern art or something like that. I don't have that in front of me right now, but I remember seeing some location pictures. And so you can actually, this is somewhere that you can actually visit and put it on a list of cool Doctor Who locations to see.
That's interesting. It does not, to my limited knowledge of this, of Spain, it didn't appear to be Spain at all. I never would have guessed that.
It's just one of those things. I think it's that some of the interiors are definitely real found places, which I think was interesting. And I was sort of watching it with half a mind to being like, oh, maybe I'll go there one day.
There you go.
But the Doctor and Bill are sort of learning about each other as they go around. And it just felt very natural. I still think Bill is terrific. She's a really good counterpart for Capaldi. I know some people like Clara. I wasn't the biggest fan. And to me, she's just such a breath of fresh air.
Totally different than Clara. I loved Clara as well. But, Bill, she's going to be just fine. I think this is going to be a fun adventure in a different way than Clara and a few of the more recent companions. She has a good head on her shoulders. Great street smarts. The doctor leaves her at the map and to try to keep her safe. Luckily, she's smart enough to figure out, why don't I just take a picture of the map?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They seem to be going to great pains to avoid a lot of the cliches of the companion.
Mm-hmm.
She's clever enough, but she's not, she's still the everyman, but she knows sci-fi well enough to know what's going on, which I really, really like. The one thing I suppose that I was a little disappointed with this episode was that because it was episode two, it felt like this would be the episode where they deepen her character a little bit more. You see that with Rose in the end of the world, and they didn't really go there yet, but that's okay. But because it was for a long time a two-hander between her and the doctor, I kind of thought that they would, you'd see maybe more sides to Bill, and we haven't quite gotten there yet, but that's okay. She's enjoying the ride, so we'll let her have that.
Yeah, I think if we can be patient, when they get to a few more adventures next week, at least on the surface, looks fantastic. And she points out a lot of obvious things, some that I didn't even think about. And usually I'm known as Captain Obvious. I mean, even back on the TARDIS, when she points out, why are the chairs way back here? Where's the steering wheel? Just great observations that, where are those things? What's the deal?
And she does it so well because Amy would do that from time to time, but they were a little bit cockier and more challenging. And that's what's so funny about this, because she isn't really challenging him when she says, why aren't the seats closer?
And the doctor takes the opportunity to remind us that, because I thought for a split second, we're going to find out what this TARDIS would be worth on the market. But of course, he reminds us he stole it.
And I love that he's playing his own myth a little bit, and it's not very impressive. He's like, yeah, I stole it. I stole it. It's what about it? She's like, okay, if you want.
They finally figure out, I like how they kind of organically, so to speak, made it to the point that based on what maybe the Vikings did back in the day when they would settle somewhere, they would take their ships, turn them upside down and live in them till they could build a settlement. And with that knowledge, the doctor figures out, he thinks the original spaceship is inside this facility, And it was. And it was so cool how the look changed so dramatically once they reached what was the hull of the original spaceship that brought the settlers.
Yeah, I loved how they changed the design. It was very smart. And it's also one of those things I think good fiction does, which is gives you little bits of information, because I didn't know that Vikings did that.
Me neither.
Yeah, it's a great fact, and it makes a lot of sense. Well, actually, no, it doesn't make any sense at all. But like, I was thinking of that. What's that movie, Fitzcarraldo, where they're sailing through the Amazon and they hit a roadblock. It's a Herzog film, and they have to carry a ship over land for about a mile. I think it's up a hill, up a mountain.
Oh my!
And I got thinking about the physics of upending a ship. But assuming that you could do that, it does make sense that you would shelter under it. So it's a nice little kind of bit of information that we'll all carry around now. But then you have that wonderful design of like the underbelly of the ship's very industrial and what does the doctor say, wet brain, which I thought was
yeah, very much so.
Is it a Mac versus PC thing? I don't know if that's because this is like the actual city itself is definitely very Steve Jobs.
Yeah, it's an iCity for sure. All gleaming white, simplistic, basic, straightforward, easy buttons. And then I guess we could say it's kind of like a PC, dirty, grimy underworld in there.
Which I'm off. I'm a PC person. I like the grunge. I like the Tennant, Eccleston TARDIS. And it was kind of reassuring to me actually to have a little bit of like engine oil and dry ice when they go into the actual spaceship.
Must have some dry ice. And from all of my years of watching Lost and trying to figure out all of these mysterious names that would cause you to have to rearrange the letters to figure out something. Didn't take very long to figure out the name of the actual ship, or maybe just the company that sent them, but it was just a random set of letters. But of course, you rearrange them just a little bit and you get the word nowhere.
You're way ahead of me here. Tell me about that.
Well, it's on the symbol, and I believe it's the giant seal right on the door, which the doctor figured out how easily to open the door. There's a seal with, you know, stars and emblem and all of this. And there's these weird letters. I forget what they actually are in the scene, but I'm like, that's got to be nowhere, just anagrammed up. Now, I don't know why somebody would name their ship nowhere. That's kind of depressing, but it seemed straight out of Lost to me.
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of Utopia as well, the Tennant Doctor Who with the Master in. Yeah, you've got good eyes. I didn't catch that.
It's useless knowledge, but there it is. What'd you think of when they reached the center of the ship, I guess, with all of those pods of people? Did that, A, remind you of maybe some Japanese capsule hotels? Or, like me, it kind of reminded me of the ship near the end of the original BBC TV version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yes, the B arc. Absolutely.
That's it. Yeah, the B arc, where they sent the most important people up ahead, and then they had the B arc with the quote unquote less important people, like telephone sanitizers and things like that.
That's exactly what I thought about. It's funny you should mention that. And of course, Douglas Adams, who wrote that, wrote for Doctor Who. So, so it all comes together. But I wondered if they were going to go. I genuinely did wonder if they were going to do that. And it would turn out that they were just like, again, like you say, some, you know, people that like did the most meaningless jobs possible. I thought that would have been a really good twist.
Yes, it would have. Probably would have upset a few people, but it still would have been funny.
Also, Ralph Little turned up, who was in a great British show called The Royal Family, and was he played a very sort of like sulky, slightly put upon teenage boy. And it was really strange seeing him as a really ticked off adult with a gun. it was so against casting. Actually, that was one of my grumbles about this episode, which I preferred it when it was just the Doctor and Bill. And I think it could have worked without the humans kind of defrosting and coming out. I understood where they were taking the plot, but I almost thought it would have been a bit braver if it had just been a two-hander with those robots.
And have us still think that the ship of settlers is on the way instead of already being there?
Yeah, or even that they would have discovered the pods, but no one had kind of thawed out. Like, I wasn't quite clear role that, yeah, but that's okay. But, as you also say, it's like a pod hotel. It's like one of those
They wake up so quickly. And it did give the opportunity for another hilarious but disturbing line when the guy with the gun wants to know what day it is. And the doctor tells him it's the end of the world. We just got here again.
Exactly. There's a list of the amount of times that we've seen the last of humanity in Doctor Who and the end of the planet Earth in Doctor Who.
It's an ever-growing list, I'll tell you that.
Ever-growing list. Exactly, yeah. But I like the way that the doctor mentions, I've encountered many of the sort of the last vestiges of humanity before. I thought that was a nice little moment.
And it does kind of take the pressure off, because then these folks here may not really be the last of humanity. There's other portions of the last of humanity that have possibly survived on the other side of the galaxy, we can hope.
Exactly. Yeah. It's I'm not one of those people that gets obsessed about continuity or anything like that, but
no, me neither. It's too complicated.
There's too much going on there. But they did seem very modern as well, is the other thing. Like, you sort of wonder how, like, what time period exactly that was supposed to be, because they could have sort of come from, you know, next year almost.
That's a good point, David. We don't know what time period they might be from. They did seem a little too close to our time period, but I get a feeling they are far from the future. But I guess we didn't advance with fashion and weapons all that far. But it's interesting how all chaos is about to happen. The end of the settlers, the microbots are going to destroy everybody because nobody can just keep on smiling. And somehow, before accidentally blowing up everything, the doctor realizes, no, wait, I've got this backwards. So he goes, moves the tubes back around, and basically, long story short, reboots the whole thing, just turns the system on and off, and kind of in some fashion, somehow it erased the memories of the bad things that have happened. And now we have a chance for the humans and the microbots and the Vandi to all get along, as long as they can keep smiling, I guess.
Yeah, there's a frustrating consistency with that in terms of how often turning it off and on again turns up in popular culture, and also how effective doing that actually is in real life, because it really does work.
It does.
I've often wondered if the Big Bang was basically just a slightly more elaborate version of doing that.
Let's give it another shot.
Yeah, exactly. We'll do it again. Yeah, you kind of can't grumble at it. Like, it does sort of seem to make sense. That was the part of the plot that I did start to lose a full understanding of it. Like, how, because it looked like there was a big explosion and that they'd all maybe been blown up, and then suddenly it goes back and everyone's sort of happy again.
In a roundabout way, that was kind of like near one of the seasons of Lost. It was either season 4 or 5. I think there was a big explosion. Maybe everybody was gone, but no, they kind of did a bit of a reset. But I think it's one of those cases where you just have to have the good old willing suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, and I'm absolutely fine with that.
Like, okay.
I also wasn't entirely clear, just having done the one viewing, the relationship between the emoji robots and the Vardi, the little creatures that make up the walls of the ship. Perhaps greater minds than I can explain that, but I wasn't entirely certain what was happening there.
Listeners, we're calling on you again. Give us a voicemail at 304-837-2278. Or go to don'tblinkpodcast.com and let us know the full story, if there is one.
And they will, Wayne. They're much cleverer than I am. We have great listeners. They're on top of this stuff. So
absolutely. And speaking of great listeners, shall we delve into some of the feedback we got on Facebook? Or did you have some final thoughts on the episode you wanted to throw out first?
No, let's talk about our Facebook comments, because we had some very interesting perspectives on this episode.
All right. Why don't you take the first one from Ray, because he talks a lot about classic Doctor Who, and that's definitely your forte.
Yeah, and he had some great points. Ray says, if we didn't know of the earlier versions of Smile, I would have given this episode a lower rating. But thanks to a knowledge of 1966's The Ark with William Hartnell's Doctor, traveling into the far future and meeting the last of humanity living aboard a starship as Earth's destruction looms, and 75's The Ark in Space, which may or may not be our classic Doctor Who homework, with Tom Baker's Doctor aboard a space station containing a select group of humans being kept in cryogenic suspension. They'd fled the Earth after it was devastated by solar flares. I gave the episode 5.5 out of 10. The sleeping humans would have had to have been cared for in some way, and the grief factor about leaving a doomed home and family losses had to be taken care of. Creating the emoji bots was the solution. This would ensure the survival of a healthy, happy, and productive human species. Human nature won out. Sad, depressed humans survived, and the emoji bots' purpose went viral, and they started wiping out the depressed people. Good thing the Doctor showed up to do a reboot on the little guys, but remember, it takes more than a reboot to get rid of a computer virus. Now, that's true. We may see those irritating little guys again. Ray's talking there about a couple of classic Doctor Who stories, one from the very, very early years, and then another from the Tom Baker years. That's what Coppola's referring to when he says, I've seen some of these satellite survivors before. It's these episodes. So top marks, top of the class, and thank you for the apple for teacher there, Ray.
Definitely. Ray knows his stuff. He's got a lot of sci-fi background. And if we have to get a specific complicated theory, Ray, I know you are the man that can come up with one that will make total sense and blow our minds. We also heard from Daryl Darnell. He's kind of on the other end of the spectrum. This is his week to give the episode a 6 out of 10. He thought the reboot of the robots was a bit too much Deus Ex Machina for me, and if this episode got wished off into the cornfield or wheat field, I'd be happy. Oh my, Daryl.
And he's a Lost fan. You would think that, well, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Albert Burge said, I love the episode. Bill is amazing. I think he's absolutely right. The episode concept was good. It was treated like a mystery, but the audience were letting it in the first few minutes, which is actually, to me, a key for a satisfying mystery, which is why Columbo is so good and a lot of whodunits aren't. I could talk about that all day. So we spent the next most of the show waiting for them to catch up, and so that part was great. So yeah, he's absolutely right. That's the trick. If you can get that balance between, and which was why Hitchcock was so great, if you can get that balance between keeping the audience in suspense but giving them an amount of information that doesn't frustrate, that's when you get good telly or good movies, and I think this episode did that pretty well.
Excellent stuff. Tim Lewis, I love Bill, but think the story was a little too formulaic. Okay, but not terrific. Now, so people are definitely split on this episode much more than last week's episode, where I was on the slightly lower end of the scale, but a 6 isn't bad, and you almost did convince me to go with a 7 last week.
And it's funny because it doesn't feel like a divisive episode. It's not something like Love and Monsters or one of those ones that is really out of the box or out of the pocket. Karen says, I'd give Smile 8 exponential death charts. He killed 2 friends and he killed 2 friends and so on and so on and so on.
Oh my goodness, Karen, bringing out the memories of, what was that, a shampoo commercial, I believe, in the 70s, so. Where, oh, my hair was so great, or the gum, or whatever it was, and he told 2 friends, and she told 2 friends, and so on. And wow, Karen, that's creepy, but very well done. And you can hear Karen on Gotham Undercover, as well as a few other Golden Spiral Media podcasts. That's awesome. Also heard from Neil in Bowie, Maryland. Is that anywhere near your area, David?
Yeah, it's very close. Neil, homeboy. Thanks for listening.
Absolutely. Neil enjoyed it, but it seemed to take a bit long for the Doctor to realize that he needed to reboot the interface.
Now, that's a very good point. He probably, if he'd have just turned up and said, oh, hang on, here we go.
Yeah,
no problem.
That's true. I wonder if perhaps because of this pledge to protect the vault, and now he's got a new companion, that maybe he's slightly off of his game. I don't know, Neil. I'm going to give the Doctor a pass just this once.
Yeah, you know, and I think that part of it was that he probably did. I mean, he did respect the sentience of those emoji robots as well a little bit, I think. And it did feel like a fairly drastic solution to kind of, you know, reboot them in that way. So I think he was probably giving them a little bit of a longer leash than maybe I would have done if I was threatened with killer robots. But that's just me.
But totally understandable. And so it's great to hear from everybody. Thanks for your comments. Most of those were left in our Don't Blink Doctor Who Golden Spiral Media GSM Facebook group. So go ahead and join that. Keep the conversations going in between episodes. Now, I failed to fully complete my homework from last week, so I'm hoping to get a bit of a pass. I did see the first part. I didn't realize it was a multi-part episode, The War Machines. But even though I only saw one episode, David, I did immediately notice the out of order sign on the TARDIS that you talked about last week that kind of made a comeback.
Well, that was a short episode. I mean, some of those literally went on for 3 months. Like, they would go on forever.
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah. But so what was your reaction to, like, that was a piece of TV, I think, from 1966. What was your reaction to it? Like, how did you enjoy it? How did you relate it to what's on the TV now?
Well, I can definitely put myself in, say, the shoes of somebody watching it back then. Because obviously it's dated, the tech is dated, the style is dated, but it was still definitely Doctor Who, and there was some very, again, sinister things going on with these war machines and all the craziness going on down at the dance club and near fights breaking out and all this good stuff. But I could definitely see why you picked this series of episodes, David, because it does kind of tie in. There's little shout outs here and there, and that did tie into the pilot.
So I may have recommended this this story before in the last season of Don't Blink, but I just there's no way I can't not say that this week's Doctor Who homework is called The Ark in Space. It's Russell T. Davis's favorite classic Doctor Who, and it's really where the Tom Baker era begins. It's his second story. And the sets look terrible. The monsters are made of bubble wrap, but it's magic. It's absolutely extraordinary. Alien, the Ridley Scott movie, ripped this thing off horribly.
Really? I must move this to the top of my homework queue then.
It's such a fun piece of TV. Sarah Jane Smith is the assistant with Harry Sullivan, and Tom Baker is the enigmatic alien doctor, and it's all to do with the last kind of vestiges of humanity out at the edge of space in cryogenics, and they're being preyed upon, and it's extraordinary. So I do recommend that everyone watch The Ark in Space on, and it's going to be on BritBox, but I think it's also on Netflix as well. So
I will definitely do it. This past weekend was just crazy for me, but I'm going to do my homework this week, David. Do you think it'll be relatively obvious what parts might have been ripped off to make Alien?
Yes, it will.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's no coincidence that and I say ripped off. I love Alien. I love Ridley Scott.
Oh, I do too.
It's one of my extraordinary film, but there is a certain similarity there. And I think we should be really proud as Whovians that Ridley Scott borrowed from something as humble as a little Doctor Who that was filmed in the corner of a BBC studio.
well put. And I like that term, borrowed, better than ripped off. And I saw Alien in the theater opening weekend. I did not want to be spoiled even way back then.
Did you really?
I shouldn't have been in an R-rated theater at that age, but that's a whole nother story.
That's wonderful. But I love that. Yeah.
It blew my mind, that first chest burster, because I had no idea. Spoiler alert, there were chest bursters. Whoa.
Well, I saw that at a revival screening a couple of years ago, and there were probably a dozen people in the theater that hadn't seen it before. And they because they absolutely lost their stuff. It was extraordinary. But you could tell it was one of my favorite movie going experiences, because, you know, everyone was there enjoying it. And then when it got to the dinner scene, the chest burster scene, the atmosphere in the room just changed. And it was wonderful. And all of us that knew were like feasting on those that didn't. And such a beautiful picture. So I love that.
Yeah. The new Alien movies, that's going to be awesome as well. I'm pretty dang sure.
Yeah, I'm optimistic too. And I'm hopeful for next week's Doctor Who. It looks great. A monster under the frozen River Thames in Victorian England. Like, yeah, sign me up.
With an elephant on the River Thames?
Yeah. I used to work at, I'm a former zoo employee. So I'm brought in. I'm ready for this.
And just the costume pieces that it kind of looks like that. I guess they're going to have to tell us where Bill gets this costume. She's seen him, but I'm on board. I can't wait to watch it Saturday night, David. Good stuff. This was fun talking about Smile, because this was just a very unique episode, very memorable visually as well as the story to me. So I just want to thank everybody for listening to Don't Blink. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Details are at don'tblinkpodcast.com.
And until next week, remember, don't blink. Oh, but do smile. Definitely smile.
Thanks for listening to Don't Blink, a Doctor Who fan podcast, part of the Golden Spiral Media Podcast Network of shows. I am the Doctor in Utah, and the majestic tale of a madman in a box are used with permission by Silver Screen Records. They're composed by Murray Gold and performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Ben Foster. Taken from the original Doctor Who soundtrack, Doctor Who Series 6, available on Silver Screen Records.